and welcome to episode 126 of Tea or Books. I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
I was about to say I'm Simon then, because you normally do. that's not who I am.
We've merged. We are one man and one woman and merged.
And today's topic suggested, who suggested it, Simon?
It was my friends Max and Rosie. I went for lunch with them yesterday and I was saying I'd have a topic, so they came up with that one.
Thanks, Max and Rosie. Always helpful to have a topic suggested, guys. Always welcome. Our topic today is, should books be banned, yes or no? Followed by a far less controversial topic, which will be comparing two books set in similar-ish periods, mid-century. Dear Mrs. Bird by A.G. Pearce and Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. So first of all, Simon, how are you? What are you reading?
I'm well, thanks. I have been to Hay on Wye since we last spoke. And when I posted photos, actually, a few people were like, can't wait to hear the books you bought when you talk about it on the podcast. And I thought, I don't think I normally list all the books I buy on the podcast because that would take a long time. I bought a lot of books. I know you didn't have that much success when you last went, but did enjoy the place. Whereas I always love the place, but I think I bought 19 books.
Why?
I know. I was running low. So if people do want to see what they all are, that you can find that at stuckinabook.com, my blog. But I will just mention a couple. So one I was really pleased to find is called Strangers May Kiss by Ursula Parrott, who wrote Ex-Wife that we did on the podcast a while ago. So that's her second novel. Ex-Wife is her first. So I'm intrigued to see what else she wrote. Not that easy to find, it turns out, from the internet, but Cinema Bookshop always has wonderful finds. And the one that is relatively easy to find, but I love the title so much, it's a Naomi Marsh murder mystery called Spinsters in Jeopardy. Isn't that great?
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Fingers crossed the spinsters survive. And I was going to talk about, I don't know if you've seen it yet, because I know I messaged you about it, Dear Octopus, Dodie Smith. Have you managed to get there yet?
I'm going on Wednesday.
Wednesday, amazing. Which may well be past Wednesday by the time this comes out. So for anyone who gets a chance to be in or near London before I think it's the 27th of March, there's a wonderful play by Dodie Smith called Dear Octopus on at the National, which is funny and moving and just, I've seldom enjoyed myself more at the theatre. If you can get a ticket, really encourage you to go.
That's a very high bar there, Simon.
I mean, you go to the theatre a lot more than I do, so it may not be your peak thing. But for someone like me who only goes maybe like once a month or once every couple of months, it's, I found it really special. And actually, my friend and I were in the fourth row in the stalls, which was supposedly restricted viewing, but did not feel at all restricted. And so we got great views for not much money. So
They're not bad, those seats. So I will say I do find them a little bit cramped. But just about to the right, anyone booking, if you are taller, it is a bit of a squeeze.
I do find every theatre seat and every theatre cramped, to be honest. And I'm not enormously tall, but I'm just under 6 foot. And that's too tall for all London theatres, I've found.
Yeah, well, you've got long legs, so.
Yeah, I do have a squat torso and long legs, something people should know about me. And the book I'm reading, sorry, I will pass to you at some point. The book I'm reading is called How to Be Multiple by Helena Debrez, which is a book of philosophy essays about twins, which Helena is a twin. Her twin sister, Julia, actually does the illustrations in this book. And I'm loving it. It's so much that I found relatable. But she's basically using being a twin and the idea of twins as a concept to talk about more broad philosophical things about human identity. My favorite line is a bit of a throwaway, but I did love it, which is that she says, I share the view that most twins have of triplets, that it's a good idea taken too far. Yes, absolutely. I will be writing about that on my blog at some point, but I think it's out in America. I've got a proof copy. It's coming out 12th of March, 2 days time at the time of recording, so it'll be out in the UK soon as well. How about you? What are you reading? How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm currently post recovery from the school musical, which I was producing for since October, and we just had it at the end of February, beginning of March. It was wonderful, kids were amazing, but it was a lot of 12-14 hour long working days teaching all day, then being at the theatre till 10 at night. So I've had a week where I've just like, also all of the work that I didn't do while I was doing that, I've now had to do as well. So it's been a lot. So not a huge amount of time for reading, but I have I've started reading The Zone of Interest by Martin Amis, because I keep meaning to go to the cinema to watch the film and still haven't got around to it. I will at some point. Apparently it's very loosely based on the book, and I've never read anything by Martin Amis, so I thought, do you know what, I'll give it a try, it sounds interesting. And I'm kind of 40-ish 50-ish pages in, and it's very interesting. So it's about the people who live in the they're living, I think it's supposed to be Auschwitz, but they are the camp commandants and the people who work there, and it's basically about their lives and their total disregard of what's actually happening in front of them, or what they're doing, their kind of disassociation of it, and how their normal lives go on and their normal concerns, and it's just like the kind of discord between the two. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm finding his writing style is quite interesting. It's very masculine. It feels very masculine, but I don't know why. I can't quite put my finger on it. But I'm not enjoying it. But it's also, I'm not sort of like, oh gosh, I've got to go pick it up. So I'm interested to see how I get on with it, because lots of people have said to me, oh, Martin Amis is such a great writer, da da da. But I've never read anything. So, and apparently this is his best book according to the internet. So
interesting. I mean, I've not read anything by him either, and I hadn't heard of that one. I heard of the film, but I didn't know it was based on a book or that Martin Amis had written it. So
there we are.
Interesting.
For both of us. I'll let you know how I get on.
Yeah, I've always just felt I don't particularly want to read him because but based on nothing. So yeah, I'd be interested to know.
I had exactly the same conversation with my head of department the other day. I was like, yeah, I just irrationally dislike him. Yeah. I haven't read anything based on, and I know nothing about him. So it's just based on absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
So it feels very unfair. So now I'm giving him a chance.
Yeah, it's good to tackle our prejudices, even if they are against white middle class men. But even Martin deserves a chance.
He does.
And shouldn't perhaps be banned.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, segue.
Wonderful.
So yes, I was talking to my friends Max and Rosie. I had to mention, Rosie said I had to mention if I talked about them that they're engaged. Congratulations, Max and Rosie. And this one came up. And I think it's interesting because obviously, I mean, people will probably guess that we're going to say no, books shouldn't be banned. But I think there are interesting things to talk about around whether a book having been banned in the past or being banned in a different country. I don't think there's a lot of book banning happening in the UK now. But whether that makes us want to read it. Because I see these, you know, themed weeks sometimes, like Banned Books Week. Everyone should read a book that's been banned somewhere. Are you more likely to read a book because it's been banned? And are there any experiences you've had where you've read books because of that?
Certainly, I remember as a teenager, I was very keen to read Lady Shatley's Lover because it had been banned. And I wanted to find out what it was all about and what shocking content it held. I was then very disappointed to find that there wasn't really any shocking content by the of the early 2000s. And it was, I mean, I thought it was a fantastic book, you know, don't get me wrong, I loved it, but I was just a bit like, oh, okay, this is, but it offered me an interesting insight actually into political and also sort of social mindsets at that time as to why people would have not wanted people to read this book. And even in the sort of 60s, thinking, you know, in popular culture, swinging 60s, and everyone's all very liberated and so on. But the fact that this still went to court over this book was fascinating to me. So that was my first experience of a banned book. And then the next one I really wanted to read after that, I went through a phase of wanting to, you know, read anti-establishment things, as we all do when we're teenagers, I'm sure. Was Dr. Zhivago, which was actually first, it didn't come out in Russia for, I can't remember for how long, but ages, and the first, it was first published in Italian, I believe, and then followed by the English translation. And again, I mean, I understood when I read it that it was political. The reasons for banning it were political, but I was also a little bit, the 15-year-old me was a bit disappointed, being like, oh, I was expecting there to be, you know, something really exciting and daring in these pages. And I didn't feel like it was quite as exciting as I'd hoped. I mean, I loved it, but I don't know what I was expecting, something really outrageous, but it wasn't there.
I think it's interesting with Lady Chatterley's lover. People might remember in the Diary of a Provincial Lady that she's sort of taken to task a bit for not having read it. At that point, I think it was available in France, and people were going, you know, across the Channel to go and get the coffee or getting them secretly sent into the country. And for her, it's more a case of logistics, being like, well, I don't think my husband would love it if I spent loads of money crossing the Channel to get this book. So I do wonder, I mean, the people who wanted to read it when it was banned probably did if they had the money and the connections. The people who didn't read it probably also didn't much care to. But yeah, as you say, there was that 60s trial where it was that the lawyer said, would you want your servant reading this? Yeah. And that's that's when the tide sort of turned, really. Most people are thinking, I don't have a servant to read anything. yeah, interesting. I think, I guess I don't know if I have yet to go through my rebellious teenage phase. Maybe it's coming, but I was never thinking, oh, I want to read this thing that might be considered shocking, not least because, particularly now, you know, we look at things that were banned under obscenity laws and then think how extremely tame they were. And you can go and get any sort of thing just on the erotica shelves of a W.H. Smith. Do they still sell books? Probably, you know, Waterstones. which would make the eyes bleed of people who are running these court cases in the mid-century. Yeah. I mean, just tell one story about The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall that I've not read, but a famously banned book. Banned because it had the line about two female characters, that night they were not parted. So I'll put the explicit rating when I put this podcast out for having said that line, of course. When I was working at the Bodleian Library in Oxford, we had somebody get in touch because they wanted to see the first edition, and it said that it wasn't able to be taken out of the stacks. So I was looking at why that was. And turns out the Bodleian Library had a process for putting books that had been banned or anything like that into this cage section where people couldn't get them, but there was no process for getting them out again. So we still had it banned in the Bodleian under obscenity laws, even though you could get a copy in the bookshop next door. So I managed to spearhead the thing to get things out of the cage. Although, to be honest, most things were in there because they were the topic of libel cases rather than because of obscenity laws.
Mm. Interesting, isn't it? And I mean, that's one I've not read, The Well of Loneliness, but I'm sure there must have been lots of books in that sort of era that started to challenge the conventions. I mean, did people ever come in and research specifically banned books in the Bodleian when you were there?
It's a good question, and I'm sure they did. There's so many people researching everything that I tend to just hand them piles of books. I didn't know what they were doing, but I think it's probably a common topic.
If during the when books were published that were then banned, it wouldn't have been, would the British Library have still had a copy?
Yeah, if it had been banned after it had been published, then all these libraries that take every book published have a rule that they don't destroy or remove any books. So if it would have been like the Bodleian where they'd have put them, well, we had basically this room that was caged off and locked so people couldn't access it and they wouldn't have been able to see them by readers, but they'd have kept them there somewhere, almost certainly. Because I think even sometimes you get something like all these books must be destroyed. Again, that was more often if it was a libel case or something.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't do that. They just say, we're locking it away.
Oh, right.
But it's been stamped now and must know. Yeah, that was the rule. If it was any book was stamped with the Bodleian stamp, it could not be ever removed from the Bodleian.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you have to be cautious. Occasionally be like, make sure it's not a duplicate because we don't want to have to keep it, because if you once you've stamped it, it's staying.
Wow, okay. So that's interesting that even when books have been banned or been told to be destroyed, we still have copies of them somewhere. There's this idea that we've got to have a record, we've got to sort of have this on file somewhere. I guess you never.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's that now, if we're thinking about contemporary book banning, I think there are increasingly problematic banning of books, particularly for educational purposes, that are concerning. And I think actually talking to young people about it, I delivered a course this summer when I was working at the Globe to a load of teachers who'd come over from the States to do a Shakespeare workshop on, you know, in secondary school teaching. There were a couple of teachers from Florida, and they were saying about how Macbeth and Julius Caesar had been banned in the Florida school system because they were too violent. And they were saying, oh, well, it's just made the kids go away and read them themselves. And I thought, bizarrely, I actually really kind of love this story, because when would a child voluntarily pick up Shakespeare otherwise? And it actually had the opposite effect. It had made the children curious, like, oh, I've been told I can't read this. Okay, I'm going to go find out what's inside this book. I think often that kind of encouragement not to read something, or this suggestion that a book contains something that's evil or dangerous in some way, just piques people's interest even more.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Like, the sort of banning we see today from that side of things is more likely to be individual schools or districts, or maybe a state of America or something, where a group of parents have lobbied to have something removed. And sometimes that's further to the right wing America doing that. But I think we're also seeing, I've seen it described as sort of modern puritanicalism, which is more around, a book is offensive, or more often maybe an author has said offensive things, and then people want those books removed. And it tends to be more described as things like no platforming or that sort of thing. Which, you know, it is a complex issue, but I always feel uncomfortable when book banning is advocated, even if it's with the best of intentions, I guess. I think To Kill a Mockingbird is an interesting example, where it's just gone full circle from initially being banned some places because of portraying African Americans in what was seen as too positive a light, now through to being banned in some places because it uses the N-word, and that's obviously offensive. It's interesting how book banning has traditionally been seen as a fascist thing, as a far right thing, and is now maybe moving more to being a left wing thing.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it, to think about also the intentions behind the book banning. So originally, book banning is a thing because we want to protect people from we want to stop people from being exposed to ideas that might undermine authority. And now it's more about, we want to protect you from people, and it's often the author themselves rather than the book itself that's the problem, from people who might harm you. And that's the way that it's positioned. We as teachers in my school have discussions about this all the time. We've got kids from all over the world who in our school who come from very different political, social, cultural backgrounds to each other. And their perceptions about things from those different countries about why we should or shouldn't read things. I mean, a lot of the American students, for example, are very anti J.K. Rowling, and it's, we can't, you know, why have we got Harry Potter in the library, for example, because of, you know, her stance on gender and things. My view is, if you don't like somebody and you don't like what somebody stands for, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't look at their artwork. That's a bigger debate, isn't it? You know, should we, just because somebody says or does something we don't like, does it mean therefore that the work that they produce has no value? And there's also issues around, is it right to prevent people from being exposed to ideas based on whose decision? You know, like, who decides what we should and shouldn't read? Who decides that this view is unacceptable? And I think it's interesting because it does take us down some quite frightening routes if we think about free speech and people's right to access whatever it is. I mean, people should have a right to access whatever they want, I think. And, you know, it's up to individual people what they choose to do with it, isn't it? You can't stop people from wanting to explore different ideas, and you shouldn't really silence people, I don't think. I mean, I've got quite a liberal view about things like that. I mean, I don't know. I had a discussion once with some students about Mein Kampf, and we were talking about, because I think a few years back it was republished in Germany, and then they very quickly took it off the shelves again. And some people were really like, no, we should be able to access this book. It's a historical document. And other people were very much like, no, it's going to encourage a new wave of neo-Nazis. And, you know, we were really split about it in the class, and I couldn't quite make my mind up either. And I thought, this one's really challenged me, because I can see why it's dangerous, but at the same time, I can also see why it's an interesting historical document. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that is really tricky, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it is an interesting historical document, but on the other hand, neo-Nazism is not historical, and because it's still happening. And circulating those sorts of ideas might, if it's a document that might make people become extremists, or I don't know, it's tricky, because I do believe, same as you, that people should have access to ideas. It's interesting, the books that are banned currently in as far as I could tell from the Wikipedia page of the UK book banning, are books that are, include instructions about how to make bombs and other sort of warfare, which I'm sure people can find on the internet if they want to. But that seems to be the sole reason left. So if it is about ideas or instructions that lead to extremism, I don't know. I mean, my instinct is to say nothing should be banned. Mm. And yeah. I don't know. It's very easy for me to be ideological about that, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, I guess it's about thinking, what responsibility do lawmakers have to protect more vulnerable people from accessing ideas and information that might harm them? But my other view is that we've kind of lost that battle with the internet. So trying to do that with books, I think it's kind of shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, isn't it? I mean, Mein Kampf, for example, will be online somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, it does feel almost quaint in some ways to try and ban books, because, you know, even if it's like a school library saying we don't want children to access this book because it's, you know, too sexually advanced for their age, it's like, well, if they have a computer in their home, then the dangers are there. You know, whether, I don't know, it's in some ways feels very old-fashioned to think that books are people's main access to types of knowledge.
Yeah.
Do we have anything else to say, or should we...
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered it, haven't we?
We've certainly covered at least the start of the conversation. I was going to mention a book called Monsters that I've not read. I don't know if you have. I'm going to see if I can find the author, which is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire, what is it, Dederer? Something like that. Which is basically about the how do you divide the artist from the art if the artist is a particularly monstrous person, which I haven't read about. I've seen lots of people talking about, so that's another interesting book on this topic.
Yeah, and I do think it's a really interesting debate to have, and it's a tough one because everyone's going to have a different viewpoint. But I think for me, historically banned books are really interesting to look at in terms of why they were banned. And I do wonder whether in future years, in future decades, looking back at this time and thinking about the books that have been banned in different places and thinking about the ideologies behind those, what people will think of this time in history, because it does reveal something very profound, I think, about societies, about what books people decide are immoral in some way. I don't know. It is a big debate, and there's lots of fors and against, and I'm interested to hear what people think. But I just personally don't think there's ever any justification to ban anything, really. That's just my view.
Yeah, and I think I will fall on the same side. So we are saying, no, let's not ban books. There we go. Official Teal Books decision, which I'm sure will come as a huge surprise to everyone who saw this title pop up in their podcast feed. Before we get onto the two books today, we do have a question. We have a lovely email from Rebecca. I do need to reply to you. Sorry, Rebecca. But one of the things she asks is about titles. How important are they in influencing whether or not you want to buy a book? This could almost be a whole episode. But I was thinking we did do, what would we call it, fancy or normal or something like that. Titles were one of my finer efforts. I also wanted to mention from this email So Rebecca talks a little bit about the titles that she's drawn to. She says anything along the lines of The Vicar's Wife or Soldier's Daughter, etc. You'll love the two books that we're doing for the next episode. We won't spoil that yet, just yet. But she says, I think that Simon has said in the past that he doesn't like Barbara Pym's titles, and I would just like to put it on record that I could not disagree more strongly. I think they're rather beautiful, and they also make me wistful about whatever literary illusion it is that I'm missing. There you go. You're a better person than I am, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca. I quite agree.
A lot of the emails we get about people disagreeing with me and agreeing with you, but I don't share them all with you because you don't need to know.
That. You know, it's all part of him bullying me. I just want to.
Everyone who got in touch agreed with you about Day by Michael Cunningham, by the way, as well.
Oh, did they? Well, and you know, funnily enough, I was reading it, I was staying at my friend's farmhouse in Norfolk, and I said before I left, I was like, oh, I'm leaving this here with you, and you can have a read. And then she texted me the other day and she was like, oh, Rach, I've got 50 pages into this book. Do you want it back or can I give it to the charity shop? I just I was like, join the club. I was like, no, please give it to the charity shop. So another person there who agrees with me.
Well, whichever kind soul finds it and buys it in that charity shop, I wish them well with it and I hope they love it.
I hope they love it too. The people of Norfolk salute you, Simon.
So yes, titles, how important are they in influencing whether or not you want to buy or read a book?
Well, they certainly influence me picking something up from a shelf, for sure. Not necessarily is it going to make me more likely to buy it, but would it catch my eye? Yes. I get very bored of the same kind of titles in terms of those, you know, anything that's like the something something, I'm not going to be excited by, but something that is a little bit more unusual or something that I think, oh, is that an allusion to something, like a literary allusion or something like that, I'll pick it up and I'll have a look. It's not necessarily going to make me want to buy it more than something else, but it's, I like it when an author makes an effort with their title because it makes me think the book's probably a cut above the rest.
Yes, I think I'm with you. I think, something I've discovered, particularly after doing Project Names that year when I read as many books as possible with people's names in the title, is that I am really drawn to books with people's names in the title because I think it says to me that character will be really important in that book and it's going to have some really interesting people in it. As you say, it's more likely to make me pick up a book. If I'm in a secondhand bookshop and it's all those sorts of old hardbacks where there is no synopsis or anything, then I'll flick through and see what the writing style is like. So I do rely more on titles there if it's authors that I don't know.
Yes.
I think it's up. Yeah, it's up there. It'll definitely grab my interest, but it's unlikely to be the sole reason that I buy a book.
Yeah, agreed.
Thanks, Rebecca. And yes, there are other things you asked that I might come on to in another time. On to a book that did change its title, Lessons in Chemistry, originally titled Introduction to Chemistry when it was sent to the agent, apparently, by Bonnie Garmis and Dear Mrs. Bird by AJ Pierce. Do you want to introduce us? Which would you like to introduce us to?
I'd prefer to do Lessons in Chemistry, if that's all right. Do you want to
go
do...
for it?
Fine.
Well, I'm happy to go first. So, yeah, Dear Mrs. Bird, because it was published first, 2018, I believe. Dear Mrs. Bird by AJ Pierce is set in the middle of the war in 1941 in London. And the heroine, Emmy, is very young and has bold ambitions to be a lady war correspondent. And she thinks that she has seen an advert that will let her do just that. So she turns up at a job interview where she thinks she might be asked to go and meet the troops and go and do all these sorts of maybe even frontline activity. But turns out she is actually being asked to be a sort of secretary for an agony aunt called Mrs. Bird. That's where the title comes from. She is engaged to be married. She's got some close friends who are sort of a little group of female friends who are still at home, but the person she's engaged to is away at the front. And she also, in her spare time, such as she has, volunteers on fire watch duty, I believe, or something along those lines. It's basically all about life in the war. It's got this newspaper where she, or this magazine journal where she is writing up or sorting through the different letters she gets. But Henrietta Bird, who runs that, is very old-fashioned, doesn't want anything nasty in there, and her definition of nasty is very broad. She is indeed, I guess, banning those letters to link to our first half, and Emmy is keen to start replying to these young women who are in troubles of different kinds. Thank you.
Very good. Lessons in Chemistry, which I'm sure many people know about now, especially as it's on Netflix TV series or Apple, whatever.
Apple TV, I think, yes. Yeah.
Okay, apologies. I'm not very up with TV stuff. I'm not watching. is a book set in the 1960s, set in California, and the protagonist is Elizabeth Zott. She is a brilliant chemist. And she is fighting against the establishment of the science community at the time, who very actively do not want a woman. And what also working with them, and what also is hugely problematic for her, is that she is incredibly beautiful. So she's not taken seriously as an intellect. She's just judged based on her appearance. And the book kind of starts with her meeting another researcher called Calvin, who... they have a terrible first introduction to each other. He assumes she's a secretary, and then over time they fall in love, and she never thinks that she's going to fall in love. She never thinks that she's going to find a man who's going to respect her for who she is, but they have this wonderful partnership, and then something horrible happens, and then after the something horrible happens, she has to rethink what she's doing, and she ends up fronting a cookery show on television where she uses chemistry as a way of explaining to women how to make healthy and wholesome food for their families. And then it goes from there. There's many more things, but I won't say too much.
Lovely, thanks. Where did you where would you like this conversation to start?
Well, what I will say about both of these books is that I went in with quite different expectations, actually. I thought that Dear Mrs. Bird was going to be far more intellectual than it actually was, and literary than it was. And I thought that Lessons in Chemistry was a sort of going to be a beach read style book. And I actually only read Lessons in Chemistry because my sister gave it to me. And I mean, this is no slight on my sister. She is a very she's a very literary person. She loves reading, but she said, "Oh, you know, I just got this from the supermarket," and I thought, "Oh, it's going to be." But she said, "Oh no, it's absolutely brilliant. It's actually brilliant. You're going to love it." So she normally, like, she knows me really well. So I obviously, she's my sister. So I thought, okay. And she was like, "No, Rach, you've really got to read it." I was like, okay. So I started reading it on the train home from my sister's. And I was like, oh, wow, she's right. This is really good. And I found the writing style incredibly engaging, very literary straight away. And I was really drawn into the story. And even though it turned out very quickly to not be the sort of book I was expecting at all. Not to mention, I might say, that my sister didn't tell me the horrible thing that happened. So I was very upset, and I phoned her and was like, "You never said this is going to happen. I'm crying." But then Dear Mrs. Bird, I thought, was going to be a kind of Diary of a Provincial Lady style book. And while it tries to be that, I just found it so cliched. It was like eating fudge, you know. It was so sickening to me, and I was really disappointed because I'd had really high expectations, because I thought this is just like totally my cup of tea. I remember seeing it in Waterstones, picking it up, reading the blurb at the back, and thinking, gosh, this sounds brilliant. And yeah, it was a real letdown. But that was just first impressions. You what did you think about these?
Yeah, I guess it's a lot of stuff about expectations here, because you'd read them both before I read either of them. Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned on the podcast a while ago how much you didn't like Dear Mrs. Bird and how much you did like Lessons in Chemistry. So I had gone into them thinking that Dear Mrs. Bird would be trashy and bad, and that Lessons in Chemistry would be a masterpiece. And I guess so. I had both those expectations changed for me, in that I will say now that I really liked both of them. But I thought Dear Mrs. Bird was great at getting across the provincial lady-esque style. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun. And I thought Lessons in Chemistry was also good, but I didn't think it was brilliant in the way that you cleared it. Or rather, I thought there were so many things I liked about it, but then so many things I didn't like about it as well, that those things kept detracting from me. So, and the main one, I guess, is that it never for a moment to me felt like we were in the 1960s. It felt like, certainly the way that people were treated, particularly women in different professions were treated, felt very 1960s. I know that hasn't completely changed, or indeed still has a long way to go. But the scene felt very 60s, but the fact that this is also one of the things that does annoy me with historical fiction in general, is that all the good people had the correct 2020s opinions, all the bad people had the 1960s mm-hmm. opinions. And it's complex because obviously, sexism was wrong then, racism was wrong then, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what I prefer about reading things set at the time is that people are more complex, and people might believe things that they wouldn't believe if they were kind and good people in 2024, but they did believe them in 1960. So 1940s, whereas to me, Dear Mrs. Bird did feel more authentically 1940s. Not as authentically as if it had been written then, but I felt much more like I was in the 1940s. Whereas she didn't seem to have made any effort to make anyone speak like they would have done in the 1960s in Lessons in Chemistry, or even really behave. Elizabeth Stott didn't feel like she behaved in any way that would have been likely at the time, I guess.
Okay.
But I thought they were both really well written. I was surprised that you hated the writing style of Dear Mrs. Bird so much, because I thought it was really well written.
Oh, I just thought it was so twee and so cliched.
I'm glad you've used the word twee, because can we talk about 6:30 the dog? The most twee thing. And normally when people say twee, I'm like, I quite like twee. I quite enjoy twee. But there's this dog for those who haven't read it, Lessons in Chemistry, this dog called 6:30. That's fine. I don't mind a funny name for a dog. But that dog was more human than the humans. Like, the dog is like, oh, I'll go and lay flowers on a grave. Oh, I'll learn about the Madeleine trope in Proust. Or like, I learn about the different languages that people speak. It's like, what's going on? Why was that dog's? Oh, that dog annoyed me so much.
I enjoyed the dog. And you know what? This is because you don't like dogs. This is your prejudice.
I did think if it was a cat, I'd have forgiven it. But I don't dislike dogs. I do like a lot of dogs, like golden retrievers and labradors. Love them.
Dogs are very sensitive, emotional creatures who are able to form very powerful bonds with their owners. And that's
I don't disagree with that. But can they understand the philosophical importance of putting flowers on a grave?
He gets it. He understands. He's an important book. You just have to accept it. There are some things you just have to accept, Simon.
Can they read Proust?
I don't know. That's what she's trying to find out. She wants to know. I mean, I agree with you. There are things about... I actually thought the book was too long and needed to be shaped considerably. I was like, this needed a better editor, I'm afraid. But I think what I enjoyed about it is that it was a light read that was still well written, and that offered... I think quite a very interesting and still very contemporary view on what it is like for women working in environments. And quite frankly, I don't think for now, for many women working in science, things are much different. I don't disagree with you on that. It doesn't sound like the 1960s, but then I do wonder, what did people in the 1960s really sound like? I don't know what they should have been saying or doing or whatever. I see what you mean though about the kind of viewpoints. Everyone's very liberal and so on and so forth. But then at the same time, I wonder, well, there must have been people who did think this way at the time. So as we think. What I loved about it was it being a book that centers a woman, that she does have a relationship, she is devoted to somebody. But that doesn't form her entire identity, and she has a life and makes choices that enable her to live an independent life where she's able to fulfill her potential and her ambitions for herself. And I also loved the community around her. I can't remember her name, but like the woman, her neighbour who...
Oh, I loved her. Yeah, she was great.
...supports her and enables her to go to work by looking after her child. And seeing that kind of... that support of her also in the workplace, those other women who initially don't like her and don't trust her because she's beautiful and they're jealous, gradually realizing actually she's right and we do need to stand up for ourselves, and seeing the response from other women when she's doing her TV show where she's empowering these women. You know, you're not just making food for your families, because, you know, you're now able to have the information you need in order to be, you know, to see your role as a housewife as being something that's not just caring for people, but it's about, like, it's a profession and it matters and you need to be educated to do it well. And I loved that element of it. I just thought it was a very, you know, a cut above the rest of that kind of genre, if you like.
Yeah, it is always interesting to see which is the book each year that becomes this big seller that isn't maybe the one that people are expecting to. There's always one book that people who, you know, we all know people who read maybe three or four books a year who will then recommend it. And this is the book I've been recommended by a lot of people who I know don't read that much for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Although I did find it interesting that everyone who described it to me centered on that cookery show, which actually comes up really late in the book. I mean, it's mentioned right at the beginning, but we don't then get to it until like the second half. Mm. And I thought that was really interesting. I did think, there were bits around it that felt more gimmicky to me. Like, why are you using the chemical symbol for vinegar? That's, you know, that just feels like you're overplaying it at that point. It's like, here's this idea that, I mean, I think my overall thought about the book, this had a lot of great ideas, which didn't quite translate into a great novel to me. And it didn't really feel like it had a heart for a lot of it. Well, that's not true. I loved the relationship between Elizabeth and Calvin. I loved that she didn't compromise who she was for that relationship. I love that he was a bit of a sort of unicorn, but he didn't feel completely unrealistic. He wasn't completely perfect. He did have a lot of flaws, but he was willing to learn, I guess. That was the main thing that made him so appealing as a hero. So I enjoyed that, but then I felt maybe later in the book that the heart had sort of faded for me a bit.
Yes, I do think it was sort of two books in one. Mm, in some ways. And I think perhaps I know it was her debut novel, and I think there's work to be done there in terms of structuring. But I think, you know, it's still a great, that's just me being a fussy English teacher. I think it was a good, a very enjoyable, unputdownable read for me, which I didn't feel that the Dear Mrs. Bird had that same pull and that sense of I didn't feel that I fell in love with these characters. I didn't feel like I needed to read on and find out more about these people and their lives. And, you know, it's interesting that you said about how you felt that Lessons in Chemistry didn't match the period. And I just thought, well, these are all just cardboard cutouts of 1940s people. And I just found it, like, every single stereotype that you'd expect to see of a 1940s person was ticked. And I just thought, gosh, I can't even do this.
Interesting, because I thought that about some of the characters. I definitely found that about all the male characters in it. They were particularly the nice ones. The nice men was basically a character that were all interchangeable. There were like three or four of them who, well, not quite. There's the nice editor who she works with, who is quite different. But his brother that she gets to know, her friend's fiance, this other guy who appears for like one page for some reason, shouting because he's gone deaf from a shell being launched near him or something. I don't know why he was there at all, but yeah, they were basically all just like kind, boisterous men. was a type. But I did think that Emmy, and I'm afraid I can't remember her friend's name, I thought they were quite distinct and interesting, and I really appreciated the sort of back and forth of their friendship and sort of their, I don't know, some jealousies of each other for different reasons, and that felt quite eternal to me. That sort of close friendship between two women could have happened in any period, although the things that exacerbate the differences between them are particularly wartime things. Mm. But I raced through it, but largely because I just read it on a long day of train journeys, so it was, I didn't have anything else to do. But I think I did particularly like the stuff in the office, the stuff around the Agony Aunt. Mm. I did think she was definitely, you know, she was a stereotype, but something I did find interesting was when she gets the job, these people were like, oh, the last person only lasted a day, you know, everyone's terrified of this woman. And she actually didn't seem that intimidating to me. I couldn't see any reason why these people had quit. She basically just shouted a bit, which she wasn't really shouting at people so much, or more just like, I don't know, I've seen a lot angrier people in offices than she was. But I did like that. I've not read about agony aunts during the 1940s before, and that was a fun thing that was right up my street. So I can see what you mean. There are definitely some, particularly around the wartime incidents, feel a bit like a patchwork of other wartime stories. But there was enough in it. I guess both of these novels are taking quite well-worn periods in historical fiction, if we can say that about a period so recent, but are doing unusual and interesting things about where they're setting them.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think there's always a fascination with these sort of periods, and I think particularly for me, I get a bit bored of these World War II. People are obsessed with writing books set during World War II, and I do feel a little bit like there's so many contemporary books from the 1940s that are brilliant that are going to give you an insight from the people who were actually there. Just read those. Like, why do we have to keep writing these cliched books offering, you know, these different perspectives, when actually it's like, you know, none of them ring true. They're all full of over researched details that also make me think like, well, you know, I can't imagine it's like just too much. I don't know, it just irritates me. It's like giving us the exact fabric type or the name of the shop just to show that they Googled it. It's just like, you know, I just think for me, it's not interesting. And I did find, I don't know. Yeah, I just found it very conventional, and it didn't offer me anything that I hadn't read anywhere else before. And I was largely annoyed because I bought the hardback and I thought, well, I've wasted.
I would agree with you if it hadn't been for the agony aunt stuff. And actually the fact that I did find it really amusingly written. I thought she was, particularly at the beginning of the novel, it sort of faded a bit, but I thought she was really, really funny at the beginning. So much heart to the novel that I appreciated. I think that was reading these two in quick succession. It seemed to me that one just had so much more heart than intellect, whereas Lessons in Chemistry was an exercise in a clever idea.
Did you not feel emotionally engaged with Lessons in Chemistry then?
I did for the first half, and it sort of faded in the second half. I think as I found Elizabeth Sott more and more annoying, to be honest. But I mean, I thought she was in many ways a great character and an unusual character. But I think it was when she didn't care that she might get everyone at this TV show fired that I sort of lost my sympathies for her, because she was quite, a certain amount of her selfishness was definitely needed. But I think at that point when she was like, I don't really care, this TV show is stupid, and all these people who are working hard to make it, she didn't really care about them. And that's when I got too annoyed with her to see her as the perfect heroine.
Interesting. I saw her as being neurodiverse in some way.
And so, yeah, it's quite possible, yeah.
Unable to empathise with other people, because she's very much sort of straight down the line black and white thinker. And she's not able to see things from other people's perspective. And it does make her difficult to work with. You know, she is a difficult character, she's not perfect. But whereas, you know, I found the main character in Dear Mrs. Bird, it's like, you know, there wasn't really much light and shade there, was there?
I do think both of them should probably be fired from their jobs. and there are indeed two sequels to Dear Mrs. Bird. I can't imagine what's in them. Oh, really? Yeah, I can't remember the names of them, but I think one came out not long ago, but I did really enjoy it. And I should say that my friend Phoebe gave it to me years ago. So thank you, Phoebe. But it felt like they rounded out neatly and didn't particularly need a sequel. So I'd be intrigued to know what's in the sequels.
Intrigued enough to read them?
Maybe another 5 years or something, when I've forgotten every detail of this one. This was actually a case of a title that did put me off, because I hadn't realised that it was an agony aunt situation, or I'd forgotten that, I'm sure someone had told me. And it just sounded like a children's book title to me, like it was going to be about Dear Mrs. Bird sitting on a tree, tweet, 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 whatever. So it felt more fae than the actual book was to me.
Yes.
Okay. And similarly, in fact, Lessons in Chemistry was a title that made me think, oh, it's going to be about chemistry. I'm science phobic. But I was wrong on both counts. It happens.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of titles, as per the question we were asked, I mean, they're both ones that were risky. I think you know, I would never have picked up lessons in chemistry. I assumed it was to do with like love, and that would, I would just like, oh, you know, like, I just thought, oh, I can't be bothered with that. And then when I realized, oh, I was like, no, it's actually about science. I was like, okay, that's more interesting.
Yeah, someone commented when I put it on Instagram, like, oh, I've not tried this because I thought it would just be too romancy. And it's like, it's not too romancy. There is romance in it, but it's no one's going to come away from this thinking it's like beach read romance novel. But yeah, I think Lessons in Chemistry is definitely a better title than Introduction to Chemistry. So I'm glad they changed that, because I do get a bit annoyed by those. There was a real phase a while ago after that Ukrainian Tractors book of people giving books titles that sounded like something like, there was what, Chinese English Dictionary for Lovers and all these sorts of things. So like, if you have to work hard to make people know it's a novel, then you're probably trying to be too clever.
Yeah.
Definitely. So to your books decision making time, Rachel, put us out of our mystery. What are you going to choose?
Well, I'm sure it'll be a huge surprise for people to say that Lessons in Chemistry is my big favourite out of the two.
And I'm going to choose Dear Mrs. Bird. So there you go.
Well,
we're unpredictable to ourselves.
There we go.
In the next episode, two books that will fit what Rebecca said she liked in a book title: A Clergyman's Daughter by George Orwell and The Vicar's Daughter by E.H. Young. For years I've wondered how similar those two similarly titled books are. And if anyone wants to read The Rector's Daughter by F.M. Mayer for extra research, please do.
Very much looking forward to finding out.
Yeah, we will see you next time. Thanks for listening, everyone.